book, as I mentioned, doesn't have to be published in the year 1560. It can be published in very recent history. Did that help?
Well, that's sort of in principle, but how in practice, when you get a book in, somebody brings in a box of books, how do you make practical choice?
All right, the question is, in practicality, how do we determine what is a rare book? Someone has just brought me in a box of books, and I look through it, and we're going to find, and this, which would occur every day, but we're going to find some old school books and some leather-bound books that have been deteriorated. But down at the bottom are three large volumes, and we look at it, and we find a date on it of 1848. And we find that the publisher was a Rice and Company, and right away we know that's important because he did an awful lot of illustrated books in the 1840s. And the title of the book is The McKinney Hall, and I've used a very example. The McKinney Hall, Portraits of North American Indians. Well, anybody that deals in books, and that book, by the way, has been reprinted as recently as just a few years ago. But here we have one of the very early printings with hand-colored, 121 hand-colored plates. And so we know immediately that here is a book. I may never have seen it before, but just by my knowledge of books and having read catalogs, and here's a set of books, because this happens to be three volumes. Here's a set of books that has tremendous value. Value from two or three different forms. I mentioned it's been reprinted, so if you want the information of it, you go to the library, you can buy, go to the bookstore, you can buy a reprint of it for $40 or $50. But here's 120 hand-colored plates, the originals of which were destroyed in the Smithsonian fire. And so they were considered, and you have to stop and talk a little bit about the American Indian. He was considered and portrayed as such a grotesque individual, picturesque-wise, until this time, when here comes along a man that says, wait a minute, there's a certain beauty, there's a certain physical characteristics here. His adornment, his feathers, his clothing, all deserve my great attention. And he then drew everything in great detail, depicting the American Indian as a fairly attractive person, as his model might. And so we find a set of books that has great demand. We turn to a reference and we'll find that at auction it sold for $20,000 in the last year. We count the plates, we make a judgment as to the condition of it, and we come up with a value. Then you write the check. Another question? Yes, sir.
Are you currently doing catalogs, or if you're doing catalogs, what have been the subjects?
The question was, do we do catalogings and what are the subjects? We tend to do about six a year. And of those six, maybe one general or two at the most, we attempt to gather books on a subject. Let me tell you that this is the joy of my end of the business. I have been working on for 11 years what I think is the definitive Christopher Moore. Anybody know who Christopher Moore was? I have the definitive collection of Christopher Moore. And you know what? Nobody cares. But that doesn't bother me. That doesn't bother me. Christopher Moore was a great literary personage. Wrote many, many books and wrote literally hundreds of introductions and prefaces to books. Aside from that, many, many letters. Best known for having written the Ruby Out of the Bookseller, which is a little poem about how the poor bookseller who was sent books out on credit now is attempting to get some money back, and it's hilarious. He had a tremendous wit. But Christopher Morley will someday find his way into our catalog. We keep buying. I mean, there are things I don't have, but I keep buying Christopher Morley. And we'll build a catalog right now. We have had a number of years ago, we did a very big D.H. Lawrence collection. Partly through buying, and then having gotten and assembled a large number of his books, we go out and buy the rest of the ones, fill in, get literary criticism, and then put out a catalog. Now, we try to sell it as a collection in some cases. It's pretty hard. We did a Books About Books catalog. We did, believe it or not, a science fiction catalog, something we have never done. Pending, we have a Mark Twain collection, a pretty good one, from a, most of which acquired from a local San Diego person who collected, and there's a lot of things that we've never done. We have a chess catalog on the back burner for really, for sometime this year, books on chess. Never done one of those. But as for a collection of books with lots of different subjects, lots of different, we don't do too many of those. Anybody else? Boy, I've done a good job today.
Sean?
Yes?
You sort of answered a thought I had that was right through my head. Is, as you collect books over the years, you find a sort of affinity for certain types of subjects, like Christopher Morley. Are there other kinds of subjects as a book dealer or topics as a book dealer over the last few years? You have grown certain kinds of attachments, and if you do, are they part of a collection that you don't mind selling?
Well, I don't know if you heard the question was, that as you progress in the book selling business and you buy these collections and you put them in these little shelves and you then add to them, if I understood right, do I ever not want to sell them? Well, unfortunately, yes to the question, but unfortunately, my wife is also my landlord. And she insists that on the first of every month that I put into her palm a check with my signature on it. And so, to make a long story short, you have to sell books. And I have a very strong feeling about this. I do not have in my house any books. I cannot be a collector of books because then I am a competitor with my customer. I can't do that. My employees, on the other hand, collect books. And this can become a little bit of a problem between, although I consider these guys a part of management because that way I don't have any union problems. you still have a large collection of books come in, and I've got my man over here, and he loves to collect in three areas. He collects any book on Denmark. If he doesn't have it, he buys it. He collects any book on brewing, beer making. I mean, any book. If he doesn't have, he's got them in many languages. And he collects books on tattooing. Now, I don't have much of a problem with it. Conflict-wise. I might just say, for example, how in depth he is. He has built this big Danish collection. He will be in San Francisco for the book fair this coming week, and then will stay in San Francisco because he is doing a bibliography on books on tattooing. And it was I who mentioned to him that the American Indians did a lot of tattooing, and that many of the natives, particularly in the New Guineas and New Zealand, did a lot of tattooing, and that he really, to be complete, has to incorporate all this into his bibliography, and he hasn't forgiven me for that yet. But anyway, to get back to my point, and I don't know that I'm typical of booksellers in this one, I cannot collect books because I am in conflict. I can, however, build collections, which I take a great deal of pride in, build these collections. My Christopher Morley collection, I truly love, because I think of him as a great literary personage. I think of him as a great wit. And sometime, many years down the road, someone will come along who has just discovered Christopher Morley, and they'll be in cobwebs up where, third floor, there'll be this collection of Christopher Morley, and someone will find it and just be elated. I'm going to tack a little note on it to why I think he was so great. But the other point of it is, yes, I can build collections and subjects and have all the joy of collecting and then turn around and sell it and keep the lady who needs the rent happy. So it's nice to be part of two worlds. Yes, sir?
It seems to me one of the problems, one of the sadnesses of being a collector in a certain area is that the peripheral items, newspaper articles and magazines, pictures, autographs and things seem to get lost. The book stays, and so you find the books and you get really interested in someone, and all the peripheral items have gone away. Is there anything we could do to preserve them better than we are?
No, that's a very good point. If you heard that question, the question was that in these collections that the book stays, it's there, physically it's there, but the peripheral items, the newspaper clippings, the literary reviews are thrown away, given away, or very frankly just decomposed because of the nature of the printing. And this is a hard question, fascinating librarians particularly, because they have a great many things in their collections that are subject to decomposition. And so there are some things you can do that are having a great deal of success. For example, in broadsides and in the pulp paper period, of spraying it with a variety of things which will preserve it and keep it. We were discussing that before the meeting, why, particularly in the case of so many young people today in disposing of grandma's effects, have no real feel for history or the surrounding areas, and so consequently it's boxed up and thrown out. And to answer your question, I don't know what you can do about it. I truly don't. I mentioned in our conversation at this table that in our own community, for example, the Calhouns, the surviving Calhoun family, that part of the Calhoun family that had married to the Custers, two spinster sisters came to our city years ago and became somewhat recluse. And everybody knew about it and knew that there had to be a lot of treasures there in the form of Custer material, in the form of Calhoun material, Civil War things. And yet they didn't have any interest in preserving it, and when they passed away, it was very sudden why the immediate family came in and just literally threw or gave everything away. A tremendous loss to the historic community. So it's a problem. It's a problem we face, and I think the question is, how do you make people more aware of the historical significance of those things that surround it? I don't really answer that. Every once in a while, you'll see an article in the newspaper that so-and-so found a copy of a rare book, which he later sold for $278,000. Well, let me tell you that for 2 or 3 weeks after that, that phone of ours doesn't stop ringing. But that slides. And so I think probably the best thing I can suggest is that about every 60 days, we insert something in the paper that says that such and such was found and sold for X number of dollars, and just keep this thing going. But it is a loss, and it's a tragic loss.
Has the so-called perfect binding affected the used book business in any way? It's so imperfect.
So-called perfect binding affecting the used book business. I think so. I think so. Because they are not permanent. They're perfect, but they're certainly not permanent. And librarians, if you do a lot of business with the librarians, they want perfect. They want a permanent copy. And these, everybody says that in 32 and a half years, your libraries, your bookshelves are going to be filled with little piles of sawdust where books that once stood. And that may be true. How much time do I have? Okay.
He has time for one more question.
All right.
let me turn to new books and relate it a little bit to that. There's some movement in this country to encourage publishers to use acid-free and lignin-free paper. Is there anything that's being done in the level of book dealers to either encourage or discourage that? And can you distinguish between independent dealers and large chains?
The question was that there is an effort by some publishers to use acid-free paper and materials in the binding process of new books. And is there any encouragement of that from the trade? And the second part of that question was the independent bookseller as opposed to the chain bookseller. The first part of that question is yes, and I like to use the firm of Houghton Mifflin Company, an old-time American publisher, who a number of years ago switched over to acid-free materials in the publishing. At that time, a great deal of expense to the publishing, to the construction aspect of publishing. It was more expensive for paper, it was more expensive for process, everything. Slowly, and very frankly, way too slowly, the other publishers are switching over. In my own opinion, that process should have started industrial-wise, rather than just with a few publishers who made specific claims on their binders. It has grown now to the point that many of your university presses have gone directly to it. And what I have seen and observed, and I think probably those in the Library of Science can help you a little more, is that acid-free is now like a sales agent for the book. It's like, it's homogenized now. It's acid-free. And so a librarian looking at it and making any kind of a judgment, she says, I know I need it now, but will I need it 5 years, and will it be here 15 years from now? So yes, I think there is a switch, however gradual, to this. It hasn't, at this point, affected the price of the book that much. If you've priced new books, though, you'll know they're very expensive, no matter what. Then again, the type of book. There are certain books that are being published, and I'll use the term more scholarly, or the illustrated, like the art book, that almost by nature now require the acid-free bindings and paper. But altogether, a Doubleday Book Publishers, for example, doesn't know the word. Random House, I think, has had some of their more expensive, in particular their library things, gone into that. But the more books that the publisher might publish in a given year, the less apt he may be to use the acid-free, which again is a fault. But quickly now, the definition between the independent and the chain is very just that. The independent bookseller is one that is sometimes a mom-and-pop operation that has grown up and prospered over the years, is owned by a family. They have one, sometimes they have several branches, but no more than a few. The chain is one that is a large venture capital type of operation. It's financed within, it's huge, it's usually computerized, they have tremendous buying power. They are bookstores, they hire people that are not necessarily book-oriented, but sometimes you find some good book people in there because they gravitate towards the book business. And I'm not belittling them, they do a tremendous job on distribution. This is their big point. They can have available at any time large numbers of books that are popular. And they kind of go in cycles, like 3 or 4 cycles a year. They bring in the books, they try them out, they set them on the shelves, they sell, and then bang, they send them back, and they try another one. They keep a certain number in what they call back stock or inventory, which they know from their history will continue to sell. That's opposed to the independent bookshop, who keeps a lot more things in the form of backlist on his shelf because he is sure they will sell, and he knows the book business well enough because he's a bookman, and he keeps a wider selection of backlist. On the other hand, he probably doesn't carry as much of the newer books out because financially it's just very, very difficult. Did that help at all?
I think you made an excellent answer to a question I didn't phrase properly. I'll ask you a separate question later.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me thank you very much for having me here tonight. Thank you.